Is the environmental movement actually growing into a great new wave of change? That's the theory put forward by Paul Hawken, the economist and author, in his new book, The New Great Transformation. We're going to hear a talk given to the Long Now Foundation on June the 8th, 2007.
Fora TV. The world is thinking.
Good evening. Welcome to the Long Now event. My name is Stuart Brand. Now for our speaker tonight, this is a hometown audience. Hometown audience, please welcome Paul Hawken.
Can you hear me in the back? Yes, good. Second, I was telling my friend as we were driving here that nobody gives shorter introductions in the world than Stuart Brand. And brevity is so much better than the opposite when you're being introduced. So thank you, Stuart. And thank you for this series. I was talking to Paul Saffo, and he was calling this his favorite conference, the slow conference. If you come to... It's just a big intermission between every, speaker. It could be called the long conference, too. I thought that might be a good idea for it. As so often has happened in my life, my work has been affected by Stuart. I'm not saying that because he's here, because it's true. And the talk I gave here previously was called The Long Green, and it was entitled by Stuart Brand. He gave me the title. That is the third chapter in Blessed Unrest. And tonight, when we are talking about a title for the talk, he said, The New Great Transformation, which I accepted, and at the same time, only really an idiot would call their talk The New Great Transformation, because those things are not talked about in real time, much less predicted. But I do think it's a very, very useful dynamic transformation in this case. The one that is conventionally thought of is really the beginning of the Industrial Age, 1700s, and that transformation to so-called self-regulating markets that Karl Polanyi outlined so brilliantly in his book published in 1944 called The Great Transformation. And you know much of that and the Industrial Revolution, but what he was saying I think was especially important. He was one of the few economists who was really synthetic. He was integrative. He really looked at all things. He did not stick to his discipline. And what he said is that the nation state had to co-evolve with the so-called self-regulating markets in order for those markets to persevere and survive, but that those markets, those market mechanisms would break away from the state, and that the state then would become secondary and sublimated to corporations, and that in the process we would lose our sustainability, our viability in terms of resources and other things. So very, very prescient work. The other and more recently titled work called The Great Transformation was by Karen Armstrong, and where she described the axial age, the period between 200 and 900 BCE, which was a time of great violence, great barbarity really. A lot of cruelty from China down through India, Pakistan, into the Middle East, up through Italy, Greece. That whole area of the world was racked with war. It was a time when many teachers and sages and philosophers arose. And there was in the populace itself a great revulsion against what was being seen. And I want to revisit that a little bit later. And so the transformation that I'm going to talk about, and I do not use that word transformation to refer to it, though, is very much within the tension or the dynamic of these two previously referred to transformations. Blessed Unrest, first of all, the title. The title comes from Martha Graham talking to Agnes DeMille. Agnes DeMille, both choreographers, had seen a show that she had won awards for on Broadway. She came back 6 months later. It was terrible. She was bemoaning her fate to Martha Graham. Martha Graham, apparently on her stoop as they went home, turned to Agnes DeMille and said that, like, get over it. We're artists. And as artists, we are never satisfied. We are always dissatisfied. There's this queer dissatisfaction that makes us march and makes us more alive than the other. This queer dissatisfaction, this blessed unrest that makes us march and makes us more alive than the other. And when I saw that phrase, it was the first time I felt I had words that titularly held what I was trying to describe. And what I was trying to describe was something that I began to appreciate maybe 14, 15 years ago. And during that time, I was giving a lot of talks around the country in Australia, New Zealand, as well as Europe, and some in Japan. And after those talks, people would exchange their cards with me, and I would bring them home and read them, look at them, and put them in a kitchen drawer in my houseboat. And during that time, I had a housekeeper, and Stuart and people, denizens know her well. She couldn't clean house, but because she was too old, she came with the houseboat. But she was an artist, and I always knew when she had been there because the house had been completely rearranged. And one day, the drawer with the cards, it was stuffed with these cards from NGOs and nonprofits and others, was full, and she had placed them all in a gold lame Bergdorf Goodman bag in my closet. And it was a very small houseboat, so I got dressed there in the closet every morning, and so I saw the cards every day. And when that bag was full of cards, I began to ask myself really a very simple question, which is, how many groups are there? It was really just simply a data point. How many environmental groups are there in the world? And then subsequently to that, I began to include social justice groups. And the reason I did was pretty simple, which is that I saw them as the same, even though they didn't see themselves as the same. And what I mean by the same was that they were both dealing with the political economic system that Karl Polanyi was talking about in The Great Transformation. And that system is one where institutionally, corporately, governmentally, however it is expressed, the future is basically stolen and sold in the present. And it's called GDP or profit or whatever. It can be stolen in the form of clear cuts in British Columbia that make lingerie catalogs, you know, for Victoria's Secret. It can be in the form of child trafficking for plantation workers in Benin for chocolate plantations. It can be in the form of workers in factories in China making chashkas, being exposed to high levels of toxicity, pregnant women. So it really doesn't make any difference. When you look at the environmental movement and the social justice movement, both are addressing this theft of the future. And to think of the environmental movement as not a justice movement really is a disservice to people and place. It is always and quintessentially about justice. So as I began to count both, my numbers started to go up to 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000. And at that point, I began to go back to the literature on social movements and try to find if there was something comparable, either extant or in history. And I couldn't find anything that had that many organizations. Now, you probably stop me right now and say, well, who says it's a movement? Just because there's so many organizations, why would you call it a movement? And several reasons not to as well. But as I began to look at the literature, I began to wonder if, in fact, because movements in the past had organized so differently, we were blind to this one. That is to say, the dynamics of this movement were so different that we couldn't see it. Now, normally in social movements, what you have is the imbalance of power being addressed by organizations or one central organization and trying to redress it. That is to say, to aggregate power to itself. Right? And next, you have centrality. You have a place, a location. And along with that, you have a charismatic, usually male vertebrate, sometimes female vertebrate, but somebody who is the leader, who talks for it, who speaks for it, who can represent it, who can, you know, give the soundbite. Right? And lastly, you usually have an ideology. You have a theory about the way things should work. economically, politically, or spiritually. And you get that combination and you've got a movement. You have an ism. Now you look at this aggregation of organizations in the world, and as the subtitle of my book says, how the largest movement in the world came into being, right? You see something very different. First of all, it is not trying to aggregate power to itself. It's trying to disperse the pathological concentrations of power. Right? A very different activity. Second, it's about ideas. It's not about ideology. You know, are there ideologues in it? Of course. Are there groups that are ideological? Of course. But the movement as a whole is not ideological. What the media loves and notices is when it coalesces. If there's a march on Market Street, if on February 13th, 2003, 10 million people hit the streets because of Iraq, it is noticed. If there's an altercation, tear gas, or something like that, the media loves it even more. So a lot of people believe, in fact, that that is the movement. But I would say, having done research now for many years, that that maybe is 1% of the movement. Maybe, on a good day. That the other 98, 99% of this movement is about solutions, is about problem solving. It is bottom up. It is about trying to figure out, yes, it tries to prevent harm, prevent further damage, but it is trying to figure out how to change things, how to solve them, how to change this relationship between people and people, people and institutions and people and place, people and the environment. And lastly, it has no, there's leaders, but no one can speak for it. There is no spokesperson whatsoever. Right? So here we have a movement that has no earmarks of a movement. Right? So why do I call it a movement? I call it a movement because in our work at Natural Capital Institute, and I urge you to go to wiserearth.org, which is means World Index of Social and Environmental Responsibility, but at wiserearth.org we have about 105,000, 106,000 organizations there. And you're welcome to log on your organization if it's not there. It's editable, it's a wiki, it's a lot of those things. But if you look at the about, the mission, the principal statements of these organizations, one by one by one by one, and what you find is you could put them up on a wall and read them and see them, you'd find that they're all very different. They're diverse, but they do not contradict each other. And this is my point. And as you go back in the history, you go back in literature, you cannot find any movement that arose with this characteristic. It's never happened. What's happened is the opposite, which is movements have begun with a very clear set of ideals, principles, you know, and then they've begun to divide and split up and split up. Every ism has become a schism. And what's so great about this movement is that it can't be divided. It started that way, right? It is completely atomized, for which many people criticize it. And say, get your act together. Why aren't you as together as, you know, ideological organizations, right? But what if we are doing something collectively that we cannot understand individually? I mean, Jim Lovelock was here. He talked about the Gaia hypothesis, and the idea of the Earth being a living organism or having the characteristics of a living organism. But many people for a long time, Spinoza, Kant, and Teilhard de Chardin, Lewis Thomas, have postulated that we, as a species, we human beings also have a collective characteristic and a collective intelligence that we create, but that we do not necessarily understand in real time. And so I'm suggesting that this movement may have such earmarks. And as I delve further into the social movement literature, not be able to find metaphors, descriptors, ways that really adequately presented it, I went to biology, I went to medicine, I went to other metaphors. And the metaphor that was most useful to me in explaining it was really the metaphor of the immune system. And immunis means ready to serve, which is handy itself, but the immune system is the most complex system in the body. And this movement, if you allow my stipulative, you know, designation of it as a movement, is the most complex movement in the world and in history, without question. So the immune system, being the most complex system, our sort of cartoon picture of the immune system is, well, like the Department of Defense. You know, pathogens come in and they're tagged and they're shot dead, you know. And so much for that. And sometimes there's too many and you're shot dead. Well, the immune system doesn't work that way. Not only is it complex, it actually is more like a chamber of commerce mixer than it is an army. And antibodies go after antibodies, and there's a tremendous amount of networking going on in the immune system at all times. And what we know is that immune system that is most resilient is best networked, that is best connected to itself within the body. And the immune system will try rapprochement or détente long before it will try to attack, not long, but before. It tries to figure out who this is, because what it's doing is identifying things that come in, if you will, microorganisms, and saying, me, me, not me, oh, that's a not me. And then, well, what should we do with this? But if it's a me, pass, 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 pass. And what this movement is doing is the same thing. Collectively, it's going humane, humane, not humane. This is not humane. And what you have is organizations and collecting, gathering. Well, what should we do about it? And they'll talk and they'll organize and they'll form what? Collectives and alliances and networks and non-profit organizations and non-governmental organizations and watch organizations and keeper organizations and village-based organizations and citizen-based organizations. I mean, I can keep going. It has so many ways of expressing itself, right? But not only is the immune system complex, right, but the analog, the closest we have to immune system in our culture is the internet. And the internet, as Kevin has pointed out with his quintillion transistors and million emails per second, is not as complex as your immune system. Right? So are we creating something that is the human equivalent or humanity's equivalent of the immune system? I think we are. And if we look at it from that point of view, then we don't think of it as gaining power so much as something that permeates all existing institutions, whether they be religious, educational, governmental, corporate, right? And permeating it with ideas, with memes, with solutions, right? That are thrown out if they don't work, which is what you do with ideas. You don't hold on to them. Ideologies, you hold on to. Right? And so if you look at the proposals, the six proposals, for example, they're in Congress right now concerning greenhouse gas and climate change. You trace them back, they all go back to NGOs. Right? 10, 20, 30 years ago. Right? So again and again, you see what this movement is permeating society as opposed to taking it over, dividing it, etc. Now, the immune system. Let's go further, which is one cell, one human cell, 400 billion molecules. In that one cell, there's 10 million plus activities going on, tens of million really, going on at any given second in your body. And you multiply that times 100 billion human cells, not to mention the 100 trillion human cells, not to mention the 900 trillion non-human cells, which are in you. You have quite a community. A lot is going on in those 900 trillion as well. But even putting them aside, in your human cells, you have one set to one octillion activities going on right now in your body, which is 10 to 100 times the number of stars in the known 15 million light year wide universe. Okay, so that's what's going on in your body right this second. And when I present that, I always ask people two questions, which is, can you feel it? It's a serious question. It's a funny question, but it's a serious question. And some people say no, it's interesting. But my answer is, of course you can feel it. It's called life. We actually feel life. We're feeling it. We're feeling it right now. If you have any doubt about it, wait till you're dead and you'll compare. Right? And you'll say, oh yeah, I did feel it, right? Right? And the other question is, who's in charge, right? Who's running the show? Right. And can you imagine if somebody did try to run the show? He'd be dead, like that, right? So again, going back to this unnamed movement, right? Like, no one's running the show. And I would say, thank God for once there's not a male charismatic vertebrate running the show, you know? Because it's dealing with what they have done for the last 2,500 years, right? We don't know who's running the show, right? Now, to give you a sense of scale, I have a clip. And the idea for the clip, I showed this at the Long Green. I've changed it, but showed it then. And the dimensions have changed. But I saw the movie Winged Migration. I don't know if any of you saw the movie. Beautiful, extraordinary movie. As one does, I watched the credits and sort of then stood up and was walking out. And then the credits came for the thanks. That is, with thanks to the following organizations. And it was just an astonishing list of organizations that really are saving habitat all over the world, and organizations that I had never heard of. And I had been on the board of National Audubon, so I heard of birding organizations and, you know, the Siberian Crane Association of Kirkusk, you know, like, oh yeah, one of my grantees, right? I mean, you could tell that these people were in places where there was no foundations, there's no grantors, there's no proposals. They just got together and are doing it. And I cried. I started to cry. I felt, who are these people, you know? And after seeing this movie, you're just like, oh my God, thank you, thank you. I'll never meet you, see you, know you, right? And this is so important, this what happened, because if you trace this movement back, you go to, really, to the abolitionists. You gotta stop there in 1787. 12 people in a print shop in London, right, announcing to the world that they were going to stop the trade in slavery, right? Well, all well and good, and we look at it now saying, well, of course, but at the time, 3 out of 4 people in the world were indentured or enslaved. And everybody's going, well, this is what humans do. They enslave people. And some of us, you know, the better of us are not slaves, but most of us are. And who are you? And you're meddling, and you're do-gooders, and you're liberals, and you're going to ruin the British economy. And they were denounced and derided from Parliament again and again and again, right? But what's so important about it was the first time a secular group got together, organized themselves to work on behalf of the suffering of other people whom they did not know, would not know, and from whom they would never receive indirect or direct benefit. You know, it was the first time. And now look at it. Now look at us, right? We do it all the time. And so the way to get a sense of scale about this movement, instead of just numbers, which I could rattle out to you, look at it this way, which is, if I start this now, which I am, but if I was to continue to roll it so that you saw the name of every group in the world that's working specifically on human rights and poverty, environment, ecological restoration, you know, the oceans, forests, I can go on and on. You would have to stay here all night tonight and be here all day tomorrow. In fact, you'd have to be here all night Saturday night, there goes the party, all day Sunday, all night Sunday night. And you continue to be here 24 hours a day, from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. On Friday, you would have been here a week. And what I would say to you is, you have to stay here another week, then another week after that, and then another week after that. So you'd have to stay here for a month, 24 hours a day, before you would have read the names of all the organizations in the world who are essentially working on these issues. Now, luckily, person who did this for me loves Star Wars. And also got tired of putting all the organizations on this wall. And so you'll see pretty soon that it will speed up. See it all in a couple of minutes. Why I say this is the largest in the world. There's nothing like it. There's no second place. The Catholic Church would fit in its pocket. So would Al Qaeda. So would neoconservatism. So would economic fundamentalism. So would all of them. He actually wanted to make this world more like it. So that's scale. And I want to go back a little bit to history, just revisit for a minute. Because in doing this, I got to go back to the Transcendentalists, which was such a blessing for me, because I grew up in Berkeley, and the person who taught Transcendentalism in Berkeley, the person through whom you had to go in order to get out of there, was Mrs. Smith. And she was an undercover Berkeley policewoman, and I was practicing to be an asshole, and I decided that this was a good time to learn, and so I made it known that she had no right to teach the Emerson, Thoreau, and everything, and she made it known to me that she was in charge. And so I was repeatedly suspended, and finally one day the dean came in, and she had died, and he came in and said, you know, she is dead. And I raised my hand, and my best Oscar Wilde imitation said, how could you tell? And I know, he didn't like it either. And better than that. Anyway, I was taken physically out of the room, and I was told to write an essay on rebellious youth to get back into school. And I didn't. And so I was expelled, of course. I wasn't suspended. I was suspended then, but I was expelled, and I never got my high school degree, and thanks to Mrs. Smith. But so going back to the Transcendentalists was such a treat, because I don't think you can understand these guys and these women when you're 17. I think it's impossible. I don't know what Emerson was smoking or what, but I mean, the fact is, when you read him now, it is a completely different experience. And really, Emerson was packaged by a Calvinist America into these little essays like Prudence, and you think he was like a penny-pinching, frugal Yankee. And in fact, he was someplace else. And the story, though, that caught my attention, and it's a brilliant, brilliant biography, Mind on Fire by Richardson, who's here at Berkeley, just brilliant. And he also did a brilliant one of Thoreau as well. But in that biography, he talks about a little-known event, but a really critical event, I think, in the environmental movement and also in the end of social justice movement. And bear with me here. So Emerson's wife has died. He's long-faced. He's sad. He's gloomy. He leaves on the 25th of December, 1832, and he goes to Europe to see Coleridge and Wordsworth and his friends there. And he goes to Malta. He goes up the boot of Italy, and he ends up in Paris. And there, Bernard Jussot and Antoine Laurent de Jussot have created this extraordinary exposition and botanical garden, the Jardin des Plantes and the Cabinet of Natural History, and these are taxonomists. They're into systematics. I mean, they're brilliant. Wallace and Darwin borrowed from them wholesale. And it's 1833. He goes there. What the Jussots have done has taken plants and shells and bones and skeletons and preserved specimens, and they have arranged them in these arrays of color and palette and form, and you can see evolution. You can see it. It's right there. No one had a word for it. There was no word for the web of life. And Emerson, for the first time, is elated. He's rhapsodic. And he goes in that night, and he writes in his journal that everything is nature, which he's been sort of thinking about and postulating, but now he knows it, that everything is nature. Everything is connected. And he starts, what is the nature of the mind? What is the nature of governance? What is the nature of religion? What is the nature of law? And he goes back and he writes Nature. That's his first book. And really, the first, very first person to read it, one of the very first persons, is Harvard's first hippie, Henry David Thoreau. He buys it. And he's so taken by it. And he reads it again. And he invites Emerson to give the senior class talk, or he and the seniors do. Then he invites himself over to Emerson's house because he's graduated, and he said, what can I do? You know, I went to Harvard, I'm unemployable. And, you know, I know how to make pencils. Right? And Emerson says, keep a journal, which he does for 7,000 pages from that point on. Amazing piece of advice. And what's so critical about that is that and 12 years later, he's arrested for not paying his poll tax. Famous story. But what isn't often understood is he didn't pay the poll tax that year because we had elected a president who knew he was going to war before he was elected. Polk, the Mexican War. And he was outraged by the war, by the conduct of the war, the injustice of the war, the illegality of the war. A distant relative of mine, Ethan Allen Hamilton, wrote a 500-page journal. He was seconded to Zachary Taylor. And he says, this is nuts. This is crazy. We will pay for this for decades to come in loss of character and integrity, this country. And what what Thoreau is saying basically is that if I am paying taxes for Texas Rangers raping Mexican women, I'm a rapist. Right? What he said, basically, was if the government is unjust, the just man is in jail. And that's what he wrote, right? After he got out of jail, he gave a talk at the Concord Lyceum, he wrote an essay, Resistance to Civil Government. And the story of Emerson coming to him and saying, Henry, what are you doing in there? And him saying, Waldo, what are you doing out there? Is so cute, but so not true. But it is so important as a story, because it really, really was a split. And the teacher and the student had taken the teacher at his word. Everything is connected. And Thoreau saw that in a social justice context. Everything is connected. And he acted on it. And it made Emerson so uncomfortable because there was this stigma about going to jail. And 1862, Thoreau dies. 1866, this essay is renamed Civil Disobedience. And nobody knows to this day who named it. No one knows where the word came from. It's not in the essay. But what we do know is that 40 years later, after Gandhi had led a meeting in Johannesburg with Hindus and Muslims voting to get arrested instead of register under the Black Act, and Gandhi writing in his journal that night, I'm not sure what we have done. I'm not sure this is good. This is not good for my career, right? Somebody from the Indian Times gives him Civil Disobedience, and he reads it. And he gets arrested, and he carries it into jail. He shows it to the press as he goes into jail. In other words, what Thoreau did was making going to jail cool. Right? How many of you have been in jail? I see some. Yeah, right. We thought it was pretty hot when we went out. I was proud to be arrested, right? And again, you know, each time. Right? But Thoreau did that, you know? And this comes up again because 48 years after that, when Rosa Parks is standing to get on the famed bus where she didn't get off and give up her seat to a white man, the driver that night is James Blake, the man who threw her off the bus 12 years before. The most amazing thing she did that night was actually get on the bus instead of go to fight or flight. Her adrenals were all lit up. Why did she get on the bus? She got on the bus because she was sent to the Highlander School that summer by Clifford and Virginia Duer, right, to learn civil disobedience to enforce Brown versus Board of Education, a school influenced by Mohandas K. Gandhi, right? And so we see the split that happened with the sort of Emersonian and Thoreauvian school, if you will, the environment, and this social justice movement, if you will, that not the only one in the world, please, but a very important one, right, that came off of that, you know. And to me, what we're seeing now is these are starting to come back together again. And I think you cannot, especially now, funders I mean, if an environmental organization does not take into consideration social equity issues, it's not really a very good proposal. And more, like you see Van Jones and so forth in Oakland, you're seeing this really coming together of green jobs, of social equity, of really combining, if you will, bringing back together the social justice and the environmental movement. Now, there is, here somewhere, one more thing I want to show you. I think if I have it right. If I don't, I'll fix it for you. I might have... I think I got it wrong. No, I don't. But what I want to show you here is simply categories. And these are just what we call areas of focus. And when we started to catalog the organizations in this movement at wiserearth.org, we sort of iteratively looked at what they do. That is, you tell us. And being inspired by the Dassault family in Paris, we decided to create a taxonomy for this movement. Danny Hill is here, and I have seen it. It will go to rebates. But it's 414 categories and then 20,000 different tags and keywords and subcategories. And when you see this, and I urge you to go to wiserearth.org, if only just to look at this, to see the immensity, the complexity, the diversity of this movement. But the thing is, when you look at it, you will see, yes, connected, 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 connected. The biggest contributor to poverty is corruption. Right? One of the greatest contributors to resource depletion is poverty. And resource depletion drives poverty again, drives deracination, drives migration to cities, 1.4 million people per week. It creates big pools of exploitable and very, very inexpensive labor, which drives globalization, which drives lower prices, which drives consumerism, which drives the use of fossil fuels, which drives climate change, which drives the heating of the ocean, which drives the death of coral reefs, which causes the loss of fisheries for the poor. It goes on and on. Right? Anywhere you start, you can make the connection. It all is connected together. And one of the things I think is notable, and what we did here, by the way, is speed it up the same way. We didn't want to watch all 414. There's our URL. But when, how can I say this? When you look at this ensemble, and that's why I urge you to go to this, what you're seeing is a curriculum of the 21st century. What you're seeing is humanity in 243 different countries, islands, or sovereignties, which is what the database consists of. Basically, rising up, a bottom-up movement, trying to address the problems. Why do we call them non-governmental organizations? Right? Think about it. And the reason we do is because there's a big, really big NGO, and it's called Washington, D.C., right? That's the non-governing organization. And there's one in Tokyo, and there's one in Paris, and there's one in London, there's one in Bonn, there's one in... They're all over the world. They're called governments. And a long time ago, they stopped governing. And they started serving. This movement is arising from the bottom up, because it's corrupt from the top down, because that's who governments are mostly serving, right? And so this is a surrogacy, right, for a tremendous vacuum of leadership that exists in the world. Now go back to the Great Transformation, the Actual Age, which is, again, if you look at these organizations and you look at their value statements, their principles, their abouts, there's something deeper there, which is common to all of them. And what was so extraordinary about the Actual Age, right? Socrates, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Buddha, Mencius, Lao Tzu, is that when you read Karen Armstrong's book, when you read the literature of that time, these people were starting social movements. These were not religions. Yes, the age of religiosity, for sure, of reverence, yes. all of these people and more were starting movements to address the suffering of other people. And they were talking about how to lead. They're talking about reimagining what it means to be a human being in an age of violence and barbarity. And independently, if you look again at the readings, all of them came up with what Rabbi Hillel did, which is really this basic maxim. Never, ever do anything to anyone you would not have done to yourself, right? The golden rule. They all uttered it. They all enunciated it. They all published it, right? Or somebody wrote it down, right? And along with that, they also said one other thing, which is all life is sacred. Child, creature, culture, life is sacred. Right? And if you take those two and you overlay it across this movement and you look at the underlying values and principles, you will find that that's common to all of them. Just non-humane. Don't do it. What can I do to help? What can I do to prevent it? What can I do to resist it? Right? And that's what this movement is about. I'm not going to get woo-woo about it. It can fail. It's got sharp elbows. Immune systems fail. You know, it's not better than anybody else. They're not nicer people. They're nice people. There's nice people everywhere, you know. But something's going on. It's the fastest growing the movement in the world. And going back to the idea of networking, what I think we're seeing now is because of cell phones and texting and the internet, it is starting to hook up in ways which were unimaginable. Even 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Stuart sent me a piece, many of you saw it, about 1 million Chinese getting together and texting on their cell phones to stop the construction of a very toxic chemical plant that would be near their home. Right? They rose up. Right? So what we're seeing now is an atomized movement that has too much duplication, for sure, now starting to change its sense of self, how it sees itself, and then how it acts in the world. Right? And this, as I said, is something that has never happened before. People say, is it too late? Are you optimistic? Do you sound optimistic? If you look at the data and you're optimistic, I don't think you're looking at the data. The data is terrible. You know it. I feel like if you look at these people, if you meet them, if you go to Wiser Earth, you look at these organizations one by one by one, as my staff has done, and you're not optimistic about who we are, then you don't have a pulse. So it's both are true, right? And I feel like the things that separate us, you know, are going to become less and less important in the decades to come. Do I have 2 more minutes, or should I? Two more? Okay, 2 more minutes. But recently, many of you know Kenny Ossible. He founded the Bioneers. Kenny is a Russian Jew. Everybody in his family knows that. He had his DNA done. And it turns out he was 40% Italian. You know. So he went to his mom and said, hey, what's going on? She said, well, we don't talk about that. Right? So we know Hawkins Cornish, we know we're Scottish, potato famine Irish, Swedish, and French. Well, records, I mean, you know, cold. So I had my cheek swabbed. I thought, this is cool. I'll send it and find out who I am. Anyway, Swiss, Portuguese, Italian, Spanish, and Flemish. And I was like, wow, I don't have to be an uptight white guy anymore. I'm Portuguese, I'm Italian, you know. And it's like, I'm hot, you know. My skin started to change, it got darker, you know, my hair, it's too late, but hey. And I realized in that instant, as it came as an email, that my whole sense of self changed. Why? Well, because of completely artificial concepts I had about self, right? But those concepts about being Spanish and Italian and Portuguese are just as artificial as well, right? We're riddled with them. And when you see somebody on the road who's hurt, do you ask them what religion, who they voted for? You help them. You have this deep, deep instinct to help somebody immediately, regardless of anything they've done in their past. Right? And I feel that where we're approaching, because of the data, because of the information that's coming to us, is that the things that have been separating us are going to become a lot less important to us. And the things that bring us together are going to become a lot more important. And I feel like this movement has to do that, but it's also an augury of the future. It is coming together, it's connecting, it's organizing, no predictions. There may be questions that ask me to predict what will happen. No idea. My job was to describe it as best I could. And I hope that if you go to Wiser, or I think that there's many more interpretations and descriptions that arise of it. Anyway, thank you very much. And I think we're into Q&A. Thank you.
You've been listening to a speech by economist and author Paul Hawken for his new book, The New Great Transformation. It was given to the Long Now Foundation on June 8, 2007.